Have you heard the bug?
Should be recording now. I look at this. All right. So we stopped yesterday on these kind of economics of the banking and fintech. So we're trying to figure out what exactly is the difference between the digital banks or fintechs, which are trying to be banks, and the conventional banking, right? So we talked about the different kind of roles that all of these banks or fintechs are trying to fulfill. And we saw that, okay, it seems like in the banking and the conventional banking side, the system works more natural in a sense that because they're so large, because they need to fulfill all their obligations and maintain the liquidity and follow the regulations and so on and so forth. So this payment system kind of almost kind of insured by the conventional banking system, right? So because they have to keep the liquidity and because they have to follow all the regulations. At the same time, they do the transformation of the liquidity and maturity, and then they also process the information in a sense that it doesn't kind of drop out from the general kind of role of the financial system of the banks. So when it comes to the fintechs, it seems like they do provide kind of similar services or almost the same services, but they provide them, at least today, in a very unbundled way or in a very separate way. So usually they focus on one or two primary roles. For example, if it's a payment system, they probably will never process any of the information, or they would, but they are not finding any use of that, at least as of today. Or if it's a B2B lending, they probably would not provide you with the payment solutions at all. So that's why it's kind of in a very unbundled way. So I'm not talking here about the very few exceptions, which are kind of full digital banks with the banking license, which are trying to operate almost as good as the conventional banks, but still they have a long way with respect to solving all possible kinds of different problems that they are having. And we will see actually in a minute what kind of problems they are having. So we talked about that. So the only thing which I will mention here is the large difference as of today between the digital and conventional banks is actually in this last part in the information processing. Because digital banks and fintechs in essence, they operate on a very, very big data. I mean, they have tons of data that they're trying to standardize for machine learning in order to automate all the decision-making processes, right? So, for instance, any ability to recognize patterns instantly. So I think I mentioned that to you yesterday, but Amazon services, they give out loans as well, right? So they give out loans for the consumer purchases. So basically they function as any credit card in essence. So the decision that it takes for Amazon to give out or not to give out the loan takes 15 seconds. Okay. So obviously there is no human involved in this kind of decision because none of the people can actually make such decision in 15 seconds, right? So, and obviously they sit on a lot of data because Amazon collects all of your patterns and behavior, what kind of goods you buy, what kind of searches you do on Amazon. Do you look for more discounts or do you buy a more kind of expensive products in a sense? So, and all this data is useful in making the decision or making the credit assessment for you as a customer, right? So, and this is very promising field for the fintechs, for the digital banks. So, because traditional banks, they actually, well, okay, they can probably track your card transactions, but I mean, that's even more difficult because you have all possible kinds of transactions in your card, right? So it's not only your daily banking, but they also could include something extraordinary, right? So if you buy just a coffee in the cafeteria, that's one story. But if you go, for example, shopping, or if you pay for your, whatever, parking, or and so on and so forth. So it accumulates, right? So it has a tons of data, which kind of becomes even harder to structure and to see where are the patterns, okay? So for that reason, traditional banks, they also have hard data on you, of course,
but they also need to rely on some sort of soft information, which often grows to into so-called relationship-based services, right? So they would like to know, they actually would like to meet you, they would like to know, what are you doing, what are your, what is your situation? They might check on your work situation, they'll check if you have a fixed term contract or a permanent contract, and then they will also combine that with the hard data, for example, on your savings behavior, on your consumption behavior, and so on and so forth. So in combination, it gives much fuller kind of picture of you as a customer, as the potential customer for instance, for the loan products, right? So, and obviously this soft data, very often, it cannot really be replaced by the hard data, right? So this is the biggest advantage probably of the conventional banks. So for instance, this small and medium enterprises and lending to these enterprises still consists of very, very high degree of opacity. So it's very hard to get any of the information about the small and medium enterprises, unless it's some sort of surveys or other private databases which are not publicly available. So if you're a bank and if you're planning to give out loan to the small and medium enterprise, small businesses, you need actually to meet with the business and you need to talk with the business, because sometimes hard data is not enough to make the decision about lending. Of course, you can forget about it and you can make the decision solely based on the hard data, but then you're probably missing a lot of opportunities of the positive NPV projects, right? So that's kind of the advantage. All right. So there are a lot of issues that digital banks still need to solve with respect to the information processing. So for instance, this information processing is always linked to some sort of legal and social implications. I don't know if you noticed that, but there are a lot of things that are happening with respect to the privacy and cybersecurity risks. So this is kind of additional risks that the digital banks are bringing into the world. And of course, I mean, conventional banks also have to deal with that, but the digital banks were kind of the catalyst for this kind of risk to emerge at first place. Right, so transforming, for instance, soft information into hard data, this is a very, very extremely promising part where the digital banks will be developing in the nearest future. So for instance, the applications of the machine learning in the area of the natural language recognition and interpretation, some sort of a textual analysis or sentiment analysis to find out any patterns in your preferences or desires and added use recognition from the social network posts, for instance. This is extremely promising. This is where the future is going to be in the digital banks, at least. And then also with respect to the incentives to collect and process this information. So banks actually have to collect this information, right? Because they're delegated monitors. So they have to monitor you because they have depositors on the side, right? So depositors trust this intermediary and trust that the bank will do its job properly in terms of the monitoring. So digital banks, they not necessarily, or at least fintechs, they do not necessarily have the depositor side, right? So they're not really interested in processing any of the information unless it's beneficial for them, right? So that's from that point of view, fintechs should have some sort of incentives to manage this risk. Right. So most of the fintechs, if we're putting this very small layer of the real digital banks aside, then most of the fintechs would not even care about how much risk there is accumulated on the other side, right? Because they have no incentives to manage this risk. They have an originate to distribute function, right? So they create, for instance, P2P lending platforms. So they don't care if all the projects would crash at the same time. What they care is that there would be more people come into their platform and borrow and lend into each other, right? And we know that most often this originate to distribute function fails very, very badly. So for instance, the financial crisis of 2008 is a good example of that, because when banks started to issue mortgages in order to sell that on the market, so originate to distribute function, so it easily goes to the bubble side, right? So let's see. All right, so the conclusions from that point of view. So there are technological advances. They're very good. They enhance competition in financial markets. They reduce the costs. They simplify a lot of financial services. They're very good. They're very innovative. They widen the group of users. So financial inclusion is a big point of this digitalization in the banking area. But in most cases, fintechs provide, of course, a more efficient way to do pretty much the same old thing that has been done by the conventional banks. Okay. So yet, I mean, nothing stops the banks, the conventional banks, the usual banks, to adopt this technologies and pretty much replicate what the fintechs are offering. So they're not, I mean, the banks are not locked in their rooms. So they observe what's happening in the market. And obviously they're trying to adjust because they want to stay competitive. Okay, so the very bottom line. So most of these fully digital new banks are very young. So they're, I think the oldest would be maybe 10 years, but that would be like an exception. So they're 4 to 6 years old. They offer unbundled services, often restricted to in one way or another. And how flexible this model, we don't know. We simply don't know. It's too little time that has passed since the emergence of all these completely new business models for digital banks, right? So once these services are bundled together and all the restrictions are lifted, then the new information processing incentives, that could be a game changer. Okay, so then we will probably see a completely different architecture of the financial system, right? Because we don't need that's true. We don't need walls in the bank, right? So in most of the cases. Sometimes, of course, branches are very necessary, but in most of the cases, there is no need for them. So, but when the digital banks starts to provide all the services without the restrictions, then it's probably going to be a game changer. Okay, so yes, and the outcomes of that yet to be seen. So we don't know what's going to be the final result of that. And then the existing traditional banks, obviously, they are very active in the field. So they're constantly adopting all the technological innovations. They're building their own ecosystems. So this ecosystems is another fancy word nowadays in the banking field. So banks don't want to be banks anymore. They want to be ecosystems. So, and that includes many other things, not only financial services, but many, many other things which are included in the daily kind of activities. Basically, whenever you need to spend money, banks want to be involved in that somehow, right? So sooner or later, the whole sector will be completely digital. That's no kind of argument about that. I think we're very close to that already. I think it's in the retail banking, at least 90% of all the operations are digital already. But it's probably going to be expanding to the other sides of the banking businesses. Well, at least, I mean, to some extent, we're going to be all online sooner or later. Okay, so what we observe now. So this is a very illustrative situation. So what is happening now? So remember this Monzo Bank that I mentioned yesterday. So it's a very popular UK digital bank. So it's reported last year, I think it reported annual after-tax loss of 114 million pounds, okay? And it more than doubled since the year before, okay? So it had to lay off 120 employees to weather the COVID-19 shocks. So that happened last year as well. Without that, they're already making loss, so they obviously need to find a way to survive. So they had to lay off. And what we have now, so this is their financial statement. So you see, this is for several years, for 3 years right now. But so this is their income statement right here on the top. And then this is their balance sheet here. So what we see is that, well, if you look at this line here, expected credit losses. So this is, I think this is in thousands. So it's 20 million, okay? And then here we have loans and advances to customers. This is only 124 million. Okay, so it seemed to me, at least, it seems like the gross loans, the ratio of the expected credit losses to the gross loans is super high. Because if you take the gross loans, that would be roughly 20% of the expected credit losses. This is super high. I mean, for the conventional bank, this number is usually, should I say, 2%, right? And the and here it's 20. So this is extraordinary. This is super high. But this is what they have on their balance sheet. Another thing, is it comfortable to sit on the pile of cash? Because notice this line over here, cash and balances in banks. And notice the growth rate. So they are up from 96 million in 2018 to over 1.3 billion in 2020. So, and there, the problem is that it's fine. I mean, it's totally okay if you have a lot of money as the bank, but they're just sitting on the cash. They're not doing anything with that. Because you see that, for instance, the in the liability side, customer deposits. You see that, okay, it grew up quite substantially, but it doesn't really transforms into the loans, right? So they took a lot of deposits. They ended up being in the cash, but it's not transformed into the loans, right? So they're not doing really their intermediary function properly. So they're not transferring all the deposits they're getting into the loans. So there is no kind of liquidity creation happening at this bank. So, and it's only, yeah, you see it's only 10%. So the customer deposits is only about 10% that are being transformed into the loans. So that's super low. I mean, why would you like to be, to sit on the pile of cash as the bank? So that's weird. Yeah, and actually in the footnote of their financial statement, it says that most of these loans are simply overdrafts. So that they are not even the real loans. So they're overdrafts. Overdraft is that when you exceed your card limit, then you have certain kind of amount that you can exceed this limit to. So if you had 100 euros, then you probably can spend another 100 as the overdraft, right? So, yeah, the actual loans is set in the footnote. It was very small footnote. It was very hard to find this, actually. But the actual loans were only 68 million. So it's almost like double or twice less than what is reported in this consumer loans. So, yeah, the natural question here is, when does actually a bank stop being a bank? Because, yeah, this doesn't look like a bank to me. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's actually quite logical that the company that has so much growth in cash balances doesn't at the same moment know how to mediate.
Yeah, how to spend it, right?
Exactly.
I totally agree with you, but I mean, you're a bank, right? So they have full banking license. So if you don't know how to spend this money, why would you attract this money? Why would you take this money in? Because this is actually expensive to sit on the pile of cash, because you need to service all these deposit accounts and so on and so forth. It's actually costly. You need to maintain all the systems that take in all these deposits. So if you're not ready to spend this money, why would you grow so fast? Maybe there is a point to limit your growth until you figure out how to start spending all this money, right? So I totally agree that, I mean, they are probably completely lost. They have no idea what to do. They grew up like two times in the deposits. Where is that? Here it is. So it's three times in the deposits within 1 year. So they probably were shocked themselves. But I mean, this is their problem. I mean, they're a bank. They're supposed to know that, right? But yeah, so this is what is happening. So the biggest question here is that can these digital banks who are a little bit lost in the business model, who do not know how to mediate, can they withstand these exogenous shocks without kind of cutting their major intermediation function? Can they be reliable for the financial system? I mean, because this has a huge implications for the financial stability. Banks are the lifeblood during the times of some sort of exogenous shocks like the COVID-19. If there would be a stop in lending, I mean, a freeze in lending, we would be in trouble. Okay, if not the helicopter money, that would be a disaster, basically, because there would be so many bankruptcies that we never seen before, right? So this is kind of the problem right now. All right, so let's quickly talk about the regulations of the digital banks and the financial stability implications, at least for the financial stability. And then we will jump into the case study. Let's see how it actually affects the market in the real sense. Okay, so very quickly about the regulations. So there are two sides of these regulations. So presumably all the regulations on the financial markets, they are supposed to make the market safer, right? So all these requirements for the capital adequacy, for the liquidity, for the risk taking, and so on and so forth, they are meant to keep the system more solid and safer, right? So there is no other point, or there is no other kind of goal of these regulations. So in the financial crisis, it actually slapped the banking sector pretty hard, not only with the losses, but also with the huge waves of failures. But it also kind of increased the regulatory burden on banks quite a bit. So there were additional capital requirements and buffers that are required. There are stricter lending policies. So and in general, these lending policies, they kind of, at first, they resulted in a very tightened lending because nobody wanted to have another bubble, right? So whenever it comes to the mortgages, at least, now there are more requirements for the banks. So what are the consequences? The market share of the shadow bank, by the shadow banks, I mean, those are the some sort of providers of financial services, which are not banks. Okay, so there could be some sort of a cooperative, but not banks. There could be some sort of fintechs as well, and so on and so forth. So P2P platforms here are included as well. But it's not only digital. It could be physical location, like somebody opened a lending shop and then they're starting to give out some sort of short-term loans, consumer loans, let's say. So there could be also microfinancing organizations and so on and so forth, right? So the shadow banks. So in the U.S. residential mortgage market, the market share of the shadow banks almost tripled within this period of time. So after the financial crisis, during the financial crisis and after the financial crisis, so from 2007 to 15, it grew from 14 to 38% market share. Okay, 38% is now the market share of the shadow banks. So the fintechs, non-banks lenders, they increased their share from 5 to 15% over the same period of time. Okay, so there is a paper in the Journal of Financial Economics, which is one of the top papers in finance. They actually analyzed the situation and they try to figure out, okay, what's going on? What exactly is the reason for this extreme growth of the shadow banking? So they found that the traditional banks retreated from this residential mortgage lending. And shadow banks basically filled this gap, okay? So because there were more regulations, because there were more requirements for the banks decided, okay, we don't do this lending anymore, or at least we have a stricter requirements. And this is, I mean, but there's still demand for this kind of lending, right? So, and this is where the shadow banks popped up. So this increased regulatory burden, so additional requirements for the banks after the crisis, they explain roughly 55% of the shadow bank growth. Okay, 55. So more than a half is explained by the tighter regulations. And then 35% of this dynamic is explained by the fintech lenders. So 35 out of 55% are due to fintechs. Okay, so this is reasonably large share. So what are the implications for the financial stability here then? So, I mean, the regulators, of course, they are aware of this. They know who are the shadow banks are. And they keep an eye on that, right? So, but it's a $52 trillion of US dollars industry right now. And if it's gonna collapse, then it would have a severe consequences for the whole financial system because it's so big, right? So there are already examples of this turmoil in some countries due to the shadow banks problems. So there's a huge wave of failures of these microfinance and organizations. And the regulator had to step in and interfere in the whole situation in certain countries. I'm not talking about Finland right now. But some fintechs are certainly fueling this growth of the shadow banks. So they're doing it digitally, but they're basically doing the same thing. So they're putting more oil into the fire, and slightly under different conditions. So they use the big data in risk evaluations for some sort of a better alignment of the interest rates with the loan performance. This is what the Lending Club is doing, for instance. And then they price their services in a convenient for the borrowers way. So they can charge super high margins for the most creditworthy. And then at the same time, they charge lower interest rates for the borrowers who are not that creditworthy, right? Because they know that, okay, this customer looks good, so perhaps we can charge him a little bit more because he's able or she's able to pay more, right? And then if they would charge the same high interest rate for not so creditworthy customer, probably that customer would not take the loan then, because he or she would not be able to repay that. So they will lower this interest rate. So this is a trick that the fintechs are doing, which is not necessarily positively correlates with the financial stability, right? I mean, of course, at the same time, there is another side of the coin that people might start arguing that, but hey, this might be good because fintechs are inclusive of making the financial services more inclusive because now broader groups of people have access to these financial services, to the lending, consumer lending in particular. Yes, that's true. That could be one of the arguments. But then who monitors the risks that are being accumulated in this field? So if the least secured or the least protected group of people would start failing on their obligations, we all know how it ended up, for example, mortgage-based securities bubble, right? Okay, so let's talk about what kind of risks. So there is from the microfinancial side, there are two types of the risk. There is a financial sources and operational sources of this risk. So the financial sources, we have maturity and liquidity mismatches and the leverage problems. And then on operational sources, there are always some sort of governance or/ process control, and then the third party reliance or the cyber security risk. Okay, so when we talk about the financial sources of this risk for the financial stability, most of this risk are coming from the maturity mismatch. So it occurs when a loan is extended for a longer period than financing is contracted for. So it's so-called the rollover risk, right? So the fintechs are not necessarily good in matching their assets and their liabilities, right? And the same goes for the liquidity. And then there's a leverage. So it's less relevant for the non-bank fintechs, but it may be relevant in some cases which are involved in the consumer lending. For instance, the P2Ps or some other types of the lending. Because for these platforms, there are no requirements. They're not following the same rules, right, as the banks, right? So there are no capital buffer requirements or any other kind of requirements for these platforms. But there are actually more and more fintechs on the market which start to engage in the consumer lending and some sort of a credit providing and basically engage in the leverage side, right? But because they do not have these things, the capital buffers, that might be a super, super risky deal for them, okay? So from the operational source, I mean, there's governance. No, there are no governance norms. You know that there is a Corporate Governance Act, which is highly recommended for banks. And it's been developed during many, many years. So corporate governance actually, or the lack of corporate governance norms for the bank managers is considered to be one of the sources of the start of the financial crisis in general, because the managers, they didn't have any incentives to monitor their risk, right? So they accumulated the risk they knew that they're gonna be paid off by selling the mortgage-based securities on the market. So that's why they didn't monitor how much risk they accumulated. by giving out these subprime mortgages, right? So the corporate governance is important in a nutshell. I'm not going into more of the details on this side, but the corporate governance is super important, and it's been monitored and it's been developed for banks. But for fintechs, there are no norms, okay? So potential risk for the financial system as these fintechs expand, it's tremendous, okay, from the corporate side, corporate governance perspective. Cyber risk, we talked a little bit about it. So there are all possible kinds of cyber attacks. I mean, nowadays, cyber attacks are almost as common as, well, it used to be Trump's tweets. So Trump is now prohibited from Twitter, but at least when he was allowed to tweet, he was tweeting almost as often as we heard about some sort of a cyber attacks, right? So, and the more the financial sector would become digital, the more kind of problems with respect to the cyber risk they're gonna be, right? So, and they need to be solved, because otherwise banks are, or the fintechs gonna be in trouble because of the lack of trust, right? Yeah, and then sustainability risk, of course, there's a recent, this recent case of this Monzo that we looked about it. So consider if this Monzo would become as big as, for example, Lloyds or Barclays. And then this Lloyds or Barclays would just sit on the pile of cash. So that's going to be a very, very sad for the whole financial system, right? So luckily, Monzo is not as big yet. Okay, so from the macro side, we have this is probably a little bit more tricky, because things become interconnected. So if you look at one bank in isolation, like Monzo Bank, I mean, we don't care, right? So if it's going to fail, if it wants to sit on the pile of cash, let it be. It's so small, it's so tiny relative to other banks that if it will disappear, there's probably going to be some sort of a wave of shocks, but it's all right. We're gonna survive that for sure. But when we start accumulating a lot of such kind of elements as Monzo in a financial system, then the risk transforms into democracy, all right? Because there is a contagion, there is a cyclicality effect, there is an excess volatility side. So macro risk become even more kind of pronounced, even more substantial than micro risk. So because it brings the systemic importance, right? So for example, the contagion, so major concerns for fintechs is the reputational contagion, because one failure is enough to burn the whole sector down completely, because there would be no trust. So assume now that if one of your banks or one of the largest banks in Finland, let's say Nordea, for instance, if that would fail, would you trust the banking system in general? And you would lose, for instance, all your savings if you have an account in Nordea. You would lose all your savings to some extent, or at least your investments to some extent. So, and you will not be able to use your credit card, debit card, and so on and so forth. So you will be, at least you will be paid off, or at least you will be pieced off, even if you will be paid off by the deposit insurance system, right? So at least you will not like that. At least you will lose some sort of the trust in the financial system in general. So if that happens in the fintech side, that's going to be the same effect. So if one of these new banks, digital banks, or any of the fintechs would fail, that would mean that people would stop using the services or start avoiding the services, this type of the services completely. And so this is the contention. The procyclicality, well, it's not a problem in good times, but as we see now, especially in the bad times, it has an amplifier effect, right? So because when there is an exogenous supply shock in the credit market, so banks usually, as we talked about it, they usually just follow the policy, right? So if there is no injection in the liquidity, they would cut lending as well. But in the bad times, it might go other way around, right? So, I mean, for the fintechs, it might go other way around. So they are not necessarily cutting the lending. So when there is a policy that, okay, we need to slow down a little bit lending side because of the inflation fears, for instance. So the fintechs, they don't care. They're a little bit more numb to the policy decisions. All right, and the excess volatility. Those are the clear things. So let's roll a little bit further because we're running out of time a little bit. So I wanted to go to the case study a little bit faster. Okay, so there's nothing really new here. So the bottom line here for the regulatory framework is that it's extremely difficult to make the same rules for old and the new players, so that the sector would still be innovative enough, so there will be no new products and new services popping up every now and then. But at the same time, the financial stability is preserved. Okay, so the EU approach nowadays is that there will be same rules and supervision for the same services independently of who's providing them. So if you're a bank who is lending money, or if you're a P2P platform, there needs to be the same rule. But the problem is that, yeah, by the way, this Finnish holding, I don't know if you heard about it. So I thought that would be a good example. They had to be authorized by the Finnish FSA as the payment institution. Okay, so they are not just a fintech, but they are authorized as the payment institution. So this is kind of an example. But still, the current regulations, what we have on the market right now, and supervision to a large extent, nobody supervises really the other fintechs. So it's geared towards institutions rather than the products and services that they're providing. So by default, P2P cannot fulfill all the same requirements as banks do, because they do not hold all these liabilities and all the assets on their balances, right? So for that reason, it's extremely difficult to come up with the proper regulation. So this is the regulatory assessment, regulatory the framework for the fintechs. This is also kind of a big problem right now and a big area for development. Okay, so let's step in into the case study. So let's see what was the impact of this fintechs on the market structure. Okay, so here you see the valuations of the recent fintechs, so around the world. Okay, so this is the global, and this is the as of August 2018, so just before the COVID. All right, so this is the 33 global largest fintech unicorns. Unicorn, you know what is the unicorn term is. So if it reaches at least 1 billion in valuations, then it's kind of called fintech unicorn. Okay, so we see, I mean, here is, for instance, Klarna, which should be familiar to you at least, guys. And then, I mean, there is Revolut, which is kind of also popular, kind of a bank. Well, there is Monzo all here that we talked about. So there are other things, but there is like, here is a Robinhood, by the way, and Coinbase. Well, this is Coinbase. It's probably a little bit bigger nowadays, but still, if you look at the top left corner, you would notice that there is actually a huge outlier, right? So there is one guy with the funny kind of looking logo as an ant. Okay, which was valued for $150 billion. Okay, so relative to all the others, this is like a giant guy over here. I don't know if you've heard about, have you heard about this ant guy? No, you've heard of, okay, some of you heard, some of you haven't, but this ant guy is coming from China. Okay, so it's called Ant Financial. So if you put them or at least this is 2018 data, yeah. So before kind of events, certain events that we will talk about in a minute. So if you put it into the valuations of other conventional banks, all right, so here we have the JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and so on and so forth. So Bank of China is over here. So the Ant Financial would be somewhere, well, definitely in the top 10, right? But then it would be actually even larger than some of the other popular banks, like the Santander or the Commonwealth Bank or Royal Bank of, the RBC, I think. So it's big, okay? Even relative to the conventional banks, so the existing banks right here. So for those who don't know, what's this Ant Financial? So this is the a spin-off of Alibaba. Have you heard about the Alibaba, right? So Alibaba is like it's trying to be the Chinese Amazon type of the business. Okay, but it has much more. I mean, it has much more branches and in terms of the business models. So it has all possible kinds of businesses. So in 2004. It was to know it used to be an Alipay. So Alipay was just a simple payment system for the Chinese online retailer. So and at that time, back in 2004, the Chinese banking sector was lacking a lot of trust from the common population, right? So people were not really willing to bring their money to the banks because you never know what could happen with this money. Maybe the government would just take it at some stage, right? So there is a lack of trust. So usually people were opening some sort of this escrow accounts for any type of the transaction. So it wasn't only to the banking sector, the trust was missing not only to the banking sector, but there was also lack of trust among people. So people were not trusting whenever they had to do some sort of financial transactions, there was a problem, okay? So this is how it emerged. So it emerged as an Alipay. So it says that, okay, there is a convenient way to make the financial transactions with each other. So here you go. Here's a solution for you. So by 2006, it became an independent payment system. And it was as recognizable as Visa or MasterCard or UnionPay in China. So it became very, very, very popular. So by 2007, it had over 50 million users with annual transactions of a little bit more than $7 billion. Okay, so at that time, 2007, remember, so that accounted almost for one half of all the online payments in China. Okay, all right, so there is already one player which takes one half of the market, right? So in 2008, it partnered with China Construction Bank to offer loans. So that was a simple consumer loans up to 15,000. And at that time, the number of users has doubled. So annual transactions surged to almost 20 billion. In 2009, the number of users doubled again to 200 million. And so did the transaction amount. Okay, so it was growing super fast. It was becoming popular super, super fast. So, and it at some stage, it just became so big that it was everywhere, okay? So this is how it looked like. So instead of using your card or cash, you just had to show the QR code on your mobile phone, and this is how the payment was taken from your account, okay? And this Alipay. So in 2011, the Alipay moved from online to offline services. So it wasn't only like phone to phone, but also with this QR code. So in you didn't need to have a wallet anymore in China. So in 2014, it was it opened a fully licensed digital bank called My Bank. Okay, so it had a banking license, and then there was a single days. You know that, right? So when there's a big sale coming, so on the single days in 2016. There were 1.5 billion financial transactions. So the value was over $17.5 billion. And then the peak capacity was 120 transactions per second through this Alipay or this Ant Financial system. Okay. So, and then on the same day, so this is one day event. Okay. So it was 1.3 million loans were issued in one day. And the value was $7.2 billion. This is huge, super huge. Okay. Today, it has 700 million users. So this is more than one third of the China population. Okay. So China, you have to think that China population is also pretty big, right? So one third of China population, it's huge. Basically, a lot of people are using that, and it's not only in the like regular shops right here, but it also it's everywhere. It's like even on the some sort of the market squares or whatever, you could use this QR code to pay as your mobile. Well, here it's a little bit confusing because there is also cash money being transferred, but the Alipay was basically eliminated this part of the businesses. And it has an ecosystem, okay? So it has all possible kinds of the businesses, as I told you. So there is Alipay, which is a mobile wallet. There is a Huobay, which is an end credit pay. There is a MyBank, which is a fully licensed. There is other services like a consumer loan services, comprehensive wealth management app. There is artificial intelligence based technology for the insurance services. There is this independent credit filing and scoring services. Okay, so also for the credit history collections. And there is a global biometric based identity verification platform. Okay, so they're building many, many different kind of things within this and financial ecosystem. Okay, this is how it looked like. So, it's in Chinese, but there are some translation here. So it's not only you know, when you open your bank account, you just see the value of the current balances on your accounts, right? And then maybe a couple of other extra things. But here you can see there are a lot of things. So this is the homepage. So the homepage even offered during the COVID times, it offered the information what's happening with the number of new cases, right? So you didn't even have to check your, news app or some other web pages to check how many cases there were today, but it was basically in your wallet, okay? So it was aiming for IPO. So, and the IPO valuations were projected to be between $200 and $300 billion. But there was a setback, and the setback came from the regulators. So they were not allowed to do an IPO by the Chinese authorities, right? But in 2019, the revenues reached roughly $17 billion with $2.6 billion of net profit. So super profitable, $2.6 billion. That's a lot of money for a financial system. Obviously these revenues are not probably representative today. We don't know actually what are the exact revenues from the Ant financial side today. But though they definitely were hampered by the regulatory pressure as well. Okay, so in December 2020, not that long time ago, the Ant financial was ordered by the Central Bank of China to rectify its businesses. Rectify means to make it clear to change, basically, right? So, and some of the listed problems, according to the authorities, again, they contain lack of effective corporate governance, okay, defied regulatory compliance, and engagement in regulatory arbitrage, right? So some of the services that were provided through this ecosystem were not necessarily provided through the digital bank, but rather through some other services, independent services, which did not have to follow the same regulations as banks. Okay, so this is a regulatory arbitrage. And then in April 2021, Ant Group applied to become a financial holding company. Okay, so that again, that was due to the regulatory pressure. So the government came hard on the after them, they had to comply. All right, so it's big, it's innovative, it's disruptive, it was a game changer on the Chinese market. So what? So we are interested for our purposes to see how the fintechs affect the market. We're interested in one of the, one of the products even of this Ant Financial. So this product was this Yubao, which is the direct translation from Chinese would be the leftover treasure. Okay, so it appeared in 2013 as part of this Ant's wealth management platform. And it's essentially, it's a money market fund. Okay, so there is nothing more. It's a regular money market fund, which functioned as any other money market fund. Okay, with just a couple of exceptions. So, but in general, the money market funds are very liquid. They're low in risk. They offer a little bit higher returns than the bank deposit, at least in China, okay, at that time when they started this. And this Ant Financial, they use this Alipay data to identify the users with positive balances in their digital wallets. Okay, so this is a very good example how the big data could be applied. So they simply looked, okay, you're using Alipay as the payment service. This is your wallet. So let's see how much you have money on the accounts on this left when you're, I mean, what is the average balance in your account throughout a certain period of time, okay? And then for those for whom it was positive enough, they sent a very kind of directed messages trying to educate about the benefits of the investments or keeping the money in your money market fund. And invited to open account was this UBOB. Okay. So the main catch there was that you could invest at any point of time and you can spend whenever, I mean, you can withdraw this money from this fund whenever you want without any barriers, right? So the traditional money market funds at that time, they asked for well, some sort of a commission, first of all. And then there was a, also, there was a limit how fast you can withdraw your money. Usually it took like 3 days or something like that to get the money on your account from the money market. So within the first 9 months of the existence of this UBO, it attracted 81 million retail investors, 81 million people. Okay, so by 2018, it had roughly $250 billion under the management and 170 million customers. Okay, so it grew just like this. All right, so basically, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because if you would be offered right now, whatever is on your in your wallet right now, even if you have just a debit card, whatever on your regular account balance right now, you would be offered an interest rate, let's say even 1% or 2%. But you would just need to sign up for this thing. Everybody would do that, right? Because it's better to get some sort of interest on whatever is left on your wallet. And this money are just for the daily usage. You do groceries with that, you buy coffee with that, and so on and so forth. But now on top of that, you also get an interest, whatever is left. So this, and it's super liquid as well, because at some stage, I think they started to offer this is about the interest rates, but I wanted to say that they started to offer ability to make transactions with the shares in this mutual in this money market fund. So instead of using cash, you could actually pay with the shares of this money market fund because it was so liquid. So now there would be no difference between if you had just the money or if you had money invested in the money market fund and pay with the shares with this money market fund. Okay, so that was a biggest catch. And also with the interest rate. So they took advantage of the absence of the functional regulatory policy in China at that time. And they swept the giant masses of cash into the fund because they had the bargaining power. Because they became so big, they started to have a bargaining power in the market as well. So it was very liquid. It was the average interest rate on the bank deposits at that time. It was like that. It looked like that. So you had for 1 year, you could get 1.75%, while this UBO offered over 4%. Okay, so there was a huge difference in interest rates. Obviously, many people opened this account or invested in this money market bank. So what are the implications? First of all, the banking sector. Banking sector was suffering because imagine that now somebody says that, hey, why do you keep your money on the deposits for this low interest rate, which you cannot necessarily, I mean, if you withdraw earlier than the maturity of the deposit, you probably would lose some of the interest, right? So, and also it's a little bit less liquid. It's not on your wallet, basically. The deposit account is a separate account, which is not necessarily in your wallet. But now we're offering you for a much higher interest rate on the money that you have in your wallet. So, and there are no transaction fees, no redemption fees, can be used like just the usual currency. Basically, you can pay with the shares of this. So would anyone still open a deposit account in the bank? No, right, so why? So most likely you would withdraw from your bank and put the money in this money market fund, right? Because it's more profitable. So in 2017, the market scale of this UBO was 215 billion. OK, Okay, that became so huge. And then the deposit, the total deposits of the fifth largest lender in China, so it was China Merchant Bank, were only $195 billion. So it already became larger than the fifth largest bank in China. Okay. So huge implications for the banking sector, because once banks are not able to attract deposits, their funding is cut, right? So they don't have funding to provide loans anymore, right? And that has even further implications for the whole economic situation or stability. So there are no more cheap sources of funding. There are monopolized money market, because there is one big guy on the market, we basically can dictate what should be the interest rates in the money market, right? So the banks cannot go to the money market and borrow from them. So basically what was happening is that banks in China had to borrow from the Ant Financial on the money market, okay? So that was a nonsense. And then there's non-bank player that are similar to deposit taking. They're fulfilling the same role as the deposit taker, but they're not following the same regulations as banks, right? And they also, I mean, they're obviously that the lower operational and compliance costs. And also in order to stay competitive, the banks probably should have increased their interest rates, which would have implications also for the lending side, because the loans would become more expensive at all the time. So that was on the banking sector. Let's see what happened on the market in general. So the Chinese money market fund could also extend the longer term credit that is funded by the assets that can be redeemed on demand, which would be potentially the same as the maturity and liquidity transformation function of the banks, right? So this money market started to already to not only from the payment side that you could use the shares of this money market to pay for your groceries, for instance, but it also started to do the other role of the financial information into the maturity and liquidity transformation, right? So yet these MMFs are not subject to the macroprudential requirements because it's not a deposit, there is no deposit insurance and it's not a depository taking institution. Basically, it's not deposits, okay? So without proper regulatory framework, any policy decisions that the Chinese government would have done in this situation could have been ineffective simply because the market is not affected by these policies anymore. The markets is not affected by whatever banks are doing or affected what this large money market fund is doing. Okay. So again, big implications. For the financial system, so typically in the times of the economic stress, people need money, right? So you withdraw your money from the deposits in times of some sort of a turmoil. And then you have some sort of a buffer to spend, right, before the things are back to normal. So this online MMFs, they could raise potential liquidity risk due to the potential maturity mismatches, right? So because they offered the redemption at time T plus zero, so immediately. So, and it was financed in advance by this Yuebao own cash. So whatever they had on the accounts, they were financing this redemption T plus zero times. Right. So when everybody starts withdrawing that would actually mean a collapse of the whole money market. Right. So when everybody would need money, for example, during the COVID times, everybody would start withdrawing that. That would mean that the money market would freeze. And in order to meet these obligations, the Shuyubao or the and financial would actually need to do something, right? To get money somewhere. So they probably would need to sell some of their assets. And this fire sale of the very liquid assets could pose even larger mismatch and lead to greater liquidity risk. So we saw that already happening during the financial crisis. So that could have had a huge implications for the whole financial stability. Okay, so let me skip that one. So those were the policy responses by the Chinese regulators. So that was back in 2008, and then there were a couple of new ones that came after that. But basically, they changed the game rules quite substantially. So they say that these online MMFs can only be sold by banks or licensed MMF agents. And then they also capped the instant T+0 redemption at 10,000 yuan. So this is roughly $1,500 at that time for a single fund. And then, so basically it meant that whatever comes above this amount, it couldn't be withdrawn at T+0 time, okay? So, and then they also were prohibiting the Simon Mas from financing the T+0 redemption with their own cash. So you couldn't use whatever you had on your balances anymore. And then they also prohibited non-banks from engaging directly or indirectly in the sales of the money market funds. Okay, so basically they said, okay, if you want to be on the money market, you got to be a bank. Okay, or a bank agent in a sense, or MMF agent. So that was a game changer. So let's see if it helped. So this was the assets under management by the Suyu Bond. Okay, so and this was in the Chinese national currency. So you can see that it emerged in the onset of 2013 or 2014. So, and then, I mean, here the growth was tremendous, right? So it was just huge within first 3 months. Okay, and then it continued growth, and then here it, again, probably something happened. I don't know exactly what happened. Probably here they offered something that you can pay with your money market shares for your groceries, for instance. So here is another growth, so increase in liquidity, meant increase in the number of people who are bringing money here, right? And this is the point where mid to end of 2018 or mid 2019 was the point where the regulator said, okay, it's enough. So as the response, the government response to the situation on the market, so the Ant Financial was ordered to actively reduce the UIBAO sites. So Alipay users, who actually, they had received some sort of notifications encouraging them to shift their savings elsewhere, okay? This never happened before, that somebody would come to you and say, hey, please take your money from us somewhere else. And this is literally what happened. So this is what kind of messages people were getting. So it says that UIBAO services is upgraded, higher returns are available, and then it was comparing. So this is your current UIBAO analyzed interest rate, and this is the rate you will get elsewhere. You see that it's higher, and then you could actually click the button and then the money will be transferred to that. So this is literally what happened in the Ant Financial app. So Alibaba, as the major company, as the holding company, they were fined a record $2.75 billion for anti-competitive behavior. So Jack Ma, he's the founder of the Alibaba. He disappeared from public for many, many months. So people didn't see him. Usually he was very active. He was giving some sort of speeches all the time. But once the government was after him, he disappeared. So people were actually worried what's going on. Maybe he's under arrest somewhere, or what the heck is going on. But this month, Alibaba pledged to spend $15.5 billion on Beijing's common prosperity drive, whatever that means. $15.5 billion. So this is the largest probably donation from the private company in China or elsewhere that happened. Okay. So a lot of money are being used for common prosperity drive. So did it help? I mean, it looks like yes. So we see that, okay, the size of this money market is decreasing. So we see that situation is getting a little bit under control in a sense. But I mean, it's still big. I mean, even relative to other money market funds, you still see that it's still relatively big. So there is a lot of things that need to be done with respect to the regulations. Okay, so, but it seems like the Chinese government was right on time to recognize what's the potential kind of threats for the company here and from the financial technology here in the sense, right? So they were able to avoid larger implications for the financial stability or for the financial system in general, right? But it came at cost, right? So at some stage, it actually seemed like Chinese government having short positions on all their major stocks in the technology industry, because the losses on the capital markets were, I mean, Alibaba lost probably a quarter of its value within, I don't know, past 6 months maybe, or even less. So 25% were just smashed. And it's not only Alibaba, it's actually, because of the contingent and interconnection of the whole sector and Alibaba's involvement in many aspects of the economy, it wasn't only Alibaba, it was many other tech companies in China. So Tencent and others. I don't know all the companies, but at some stage it actually looked like the Chinese government really shorting their stocks and then hammering them with the regulations. So they made it hard way. Okay, so the solution in this case was harder for the company perspective, because the company has lost a lot of their valuations. Yeah, any questions? I'm just checking if somebody having a question on the chat, but it doesn't look like that. Okay, good. All right, so this is the last part of my lecture. So we have roughly 20, 25 minutes left. So in the last part, I would like to talk about the implications of the digital banking for the monetary policy. Because so far we've seen that, digital banks are fine, they're doing things nicely, they're cool, but they might be actually problematic when it comes to the monetary policy, especially when it comes to the monetary policy, because they're not reacting to the shocks in the same way as banks, right? So for that purposes, we need to analyze, we need to understand, first of all, how the digital banks are responding to the monetary policies. And if they're responding differently, we need to figure out what to do with that in order for the monetary policy to stay effective, right? Because if it's not effective, I mean, you can forget then just about the monetary policy completely, right? So you would be having less tools as the regulators and supervisory authority, you would be having less tools influencing the economic situation in the country. All right, so this is a master's level course. I'm not getting into much of the details on the basics of the monetary policy transmitting channels, but basically there are four different channels, right? So, or there are actually more, but the main ones are four. So there is a credit channel, which affects the credit supply. There is a wealth channel, which is affecting the asset prices. There's an interest rate channel, which is also affecting the deposit rate and consequently the lending rate. And then there is a balance sheet channel, which affects the asset prices and the collateral value, right? So those are the basics, the macroeconomics 101. So let's look at each of these channels, because those are the channels how the monetary policy works, right? So, and we know how it works pretty well nowadays. We know how it works if there are usual normal conventional banks. When there is a fintech or when there's a digital bank, we don't know how it works. So let's see. So for the balance sheet channel, so it affects the asset prices and it changes in the collateral value. So for instance, if asset prices decline, the value of the net assets goes down, right? So the value of the collateral falls too. And then there is some sort of a slowdown in lending happening, which reduces the investments and consumptions and the aggregate demand. Okay, so we know how it works. So in case of the fintechs, the lending is, most of the lending of the fintechs nowadays is unsecured. Okay, so you don't actually need to have a collateral in order to take the loan in the P2P platform, right? So most of these loans are unsecured. Most of the loans in the whole shadow banking sector is unsecured, okay? So there is no collateral value. So you cannot really affect the value of the collateral in order to affect the lending side of the business, right? Because you don't need the collateral. So, and therefore it's less sensitive to changes in this value, right? So because whoever borrows from the P2P They don't care what happens with the collateral value. They don't care what happens with the asset prices because they don't need to provide any collateral, right? So arbitrary choosing the non-bank to tap the credit, the fintechs may potentially numb the balance sheet channel and cause the over-leverage, okay? So those are the theoretical predictions at least. When it comes to the credit channel, I mean, this is how the policy works through the interest rate changes, right? So the key interest rate changes, money market rates or the bank's funding base or deposit prices and the bank balance sheets. So once it becomes difficult for a bank to refinance, banks usually cut lending, right? So because they are not able to attract money, they are not giving out money that much anymore. So they cut lending. So the high interest rates raise default risk, higher default risk bans new lending, and this is postpones the consumption and investments in general in the economy, right? So this is basics. So in case of the fintech, we actually have one paper which look at this particular case. So in case of the non-bank lending or lending based on the automated big data decisions, right? So some sort of innovative, not necessarily digital banks, but some sort of fintech platforms. So the credit channel may be amplified, actually, because the traditional banks, they're based on the relationship lending, and they have lower incentives to impose additional kind of burdens, such as high interest rate to the customers whom they already know, right? So if you are a good partners with your bank as the company, there is a lower chances that the bank would come to you and say, hey, you know what? We've been working together for 10 years. Why don't you pay him a little bit more? Because, you know, there is an increase in the interest rate right now. So why don't you start paying 5% more now? So it's less likely to happen, right? So the banks would try to maintain their relationship. They would try to keep their customers. So they might increase it, but the increase probably is not going to be as big as the rest of the market, right? So so it slows down the transmission of the money balls in case of the traditional banks. In case of the fintechs, it doesn't really isolate from the monetary policy shocks with the via the credit channels, because I mean they don't have any relationships with anyone, right? So they're just the platforms that provide lending or provide the meeting platform between the investors and the borrowers. And for that reason, it could go like once the interest rates rise, people start thinking that, okay, now they can make even more money on this platform. They start bringing even more money to the platform as investors. And then that could, I mean, there are always people who would need this financing, and they probably would start taking even more risk. So that could be an amplifying effect. Okay. So in case of the interest rate channel, there is if there is a rise in the key interest rate, which triggers the rise in the real rate and the cost of capital, right? So this is the basics. And therefore, there would be some sort of a slowdown in the investment and consumption, and that would increase the savings as well. But it would also lower the demand because there would be a downward pressure on prices and tighter conditions on the labor and the intermediate good market. So in case of the fintechs, the higher interest rate would imply a higher returns on the riskless assets, right? And that would be having a decrease in the effect or decrease in the demand for the risky assets, okay? So the capital requirements might give banks incentives to grind down the risk taken a little bit by, for example, replacing these high yielding assets with the low risk, low return assets. But there are no capital requirements for the fintechs, and therefore they're not sensitive to this channel at all. Okay, so that would numb this channel for the fintechs because they are not following the same requirements of the bank. And finally, the wealth channel for fintechs. So fintechs presumably they improve this financial inclusion, right? And they improve the participation of people in the financial markets, so they become it more available. And in many cases, cheaper to participate in the financial markets. So that would boost the consumer spending and the assets, right? And then the changes in the monetary policy, they can actually amplify the effect via the wealth channel as more people are affected by this channel nowadays, right? Because there are more people included in this channel, there would be an amplifier effect, because the effect would be larger because there are more people involved in that. There is actually a very, very early stage working paper, and this is the major reason why I didn't include it in this as the reference here. But it just came out as an Enberg working paper, and it's using the data from Ant Financial. Okay, so it uses the data from the consumers or the customers of this Ant Financial. And then they try to examine what happens with the risk taken of ordinary people when they get access to the Ant Financial, to the capital markets through this Ant Financial. Okay. So what they find is that it seems like the fintech or the availability of this Ant Financial, it improves substantially the risk properties for the regular people, for the investors, for the retail investors. But I mean, this is the conclusion. I shouldn't say that, but the authors were from China as well, right? So they kind of make the conclusion that the availability of these fintech technologies are improving the risk properties of individual investors. But what is the difference between improving the risk properties and increasing the risk taken of the retail investors? Okay, to me that sounds a little bit as the same thing. So the risk taken of the investors becomes higher once they get access to this platform to the capital markets, and it's extremely difficult to measure if it was because of some sort of inclusion and general availability of the technology or the access to the capital market, or if it triggered excessive risk taken by the individual investors. Okay, so in both cases, the wealth channel would be amplified with the fintechs, simply because there are more and more people involved in this. Okay, so as the summary for this, we can make only theoretical predictions here, right? So there is a very, very few empirical evidence as of today on the monetary policy transmission channels and fintechs. But what we kind of expect from the fintechs and their influence on the transmission channels is that some channels may be amplified by the fintechs, and then other channels would be numbed by the fintechs. Okay, so the numbing effect would help this balance sheet and interest rate channels, and then amplifying the credit and the wealth channels. So macroprudential policies that the regulators are coming up with, especially the most recent ones after the financial crisis of 2008. So they were aimed at the resilience of the banking system. Okay, so they wanted to make the system safer so that when there is some sort of a shock happening, the banks would be prepared for this kind of shocks, right? So, and also the implications for the economy, right? So when there is a monetary policy change, the banks would be affected immediately, so that the economy would be affected immediately through the monetary policy change, right? So all the existing regulations which came after the financial crisis were aimed kind of to sharpen, let's say, the monetary policy transmission channel. So all this work that has been done after the financial crisis from the regulatory point of view, all of this work would be completely compromised if it can be avoided via some sort of regulatory arbitrage and competing fintech activities, right? Because as we see, the fintechs are not necessarily following the same regulations. One, they're exhibiting different behavior with respect to the monetary policy transmission in different channels. And then the third of all, they are becoming more and more popular in a sense. So there are more and more people. So at some stage, if the fintechs would be greater than the banking sector, then we would have actually a huge problem, because monetary policy would not work in the same way as it works today. Yeah, so there is actually a very early evidence. So this is the working paper, the June 20th. Last time I checked, it was still a working paper. So this is the fintech developments in China. They find that the fintech development in China allows to explore how the effects of the monetary policy shocks change with the usage of fintech. So the results are twofold. So there are good and bad news. So the good news is that fintechs improve the transmission efficiency of the monetary policy to the real GDP growth, inflation, loan growth, and housing price growth. But the bad news is that monetary policy transmission is actually muted when fintech credit is increasingly used. Okay, so when there are a lot of users of the fintechs, then the monetary policy transmission basically stops working, right? So MP works most efficiently in the areas with the small shadow banking sector and high fintech adoption. Okay, but when there are both, when their shadow banking sector is big, MP would not work as efficient as it could. So this is a very early evidence, as I told you. There are not that many papers yet out there. There's not that much of the analysis has been done. So this would be potentially a very promising area for your, for instance, research in the master's thesis or some other occasions. All right, any questions? I put up the a list of references for you. So all these references are the citations for the papers that I was talking about during these two-day lectures. So you can easily find them on Google. If you just Google the title of the paper or the authors, you will easily find them. So yeah, that's about it. If you have any questions, here's my email address. Feel free to drop me a line if you're interested in the subject and the topic. As I told you yesterday, there are actually not that many people who are specializing in this nowadays. So it's a growing area. It's a hot topic, definitely. And there are not that many specialists and not that many experts in this area. So if you feel like you need to talk with somebody about this, feel free to drop me an email and we can come up with some sort of discussion on the idea. Okay. Any questions? If anyone from the Zoom participants wants to send a message in the chat, feel free. Otherwise, I will stop recording now.